This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Welcome to the iHeartRadio and Coast to Coast AM Paranormal Podcast Network. This is the place to be if you're ready for the best podcasts of the paranormal. Curious and sometimes unexplained. Now listen to this.
Welcome to our podcast. Please be aware the thoughts and opinions expressed by the host are their thoughts and opinions only and do not reflect those of iHeartMedia, iHeartRadio, Coast to Coast AM, employees of Premier Networks, or their sponsors and associates. We would like to encourage you to do your own research and discover the subject matter for yourself. Hi, I'm Sandra Champlain. For over 25 years, I've been on a journey to prove the existence of life after death. On each episode, we'll discuss the reasons we now know that our loved ones have survived physical death, and so will we. Welcome to Shades of the Afterlife. Have you ever had to deal with a nasty skeptic? You know the ones I'm talking about. You share your belief or your thoughts about the afterlife, and they shut you right down. There's nothing you can do or say that can convince them. The International Association for Near-Death Studies, also called IANS.org, is our partner in changing the conversation about the reality of the afterlife. Each year, they host a conference that all are welcome to attend. Coming up in August of 2024, you can join the conference live in Phoenix, Arizona. Details at conference.ians.org. Today, you'll meet four highly respected panelists, including doctors, professors, and scientists, Eben Alexander, Neil Grossman, Marjorie Woollacott, and Stefan Schwartz. You'll hear their views on skepticism, these nasty skeptics, how we deal with them, and ultimately, how we can transform the world. So let's start off with Dr. Eben Alexander, neurosurgeon and author of the book, Proof of Heaven.
I had spent the first 54 years of my life honing a very kind of conventional scientific worldview. I had the advantage as a youth of my father being very scientific. He was chairman of a neurosurgical training program, but he also had a very strong faith in God and power of prayer. He was deeply spiritual, but also deeply scientific. I wanted to believe all that I'd learned in my Methodist church, but in that career building up towards being a neurosurgeon and trying to make sense of consciousness, mind, and brain, I just couldn't understand how consciousness could survive independently of the brain. I bought into the materialist position of brain creating consciousness, physical world being all there is. And I now realize that I just had it 180 degrees wrong. My point, as I often make these days, is to the true open-minded skeptic, I mean, a truly educated, open-minded doubter of all skeptic, the first position they reject from materialism to idealism and all the various dualisms relating mind and brain, the one that's the most ridiculous is materialism. It's the one that is the absolutely most hopeless. And so it's really just a complete flip from what I believed before, but it's the one that makes far more sense.
He was asked what recommendation he'd have to a skeptic.
I would recommend a strong personal experience. Good news is that doesn't mean being smote down by a truck or meningitis or anything else like that. We're all conscious, so we have the ability to go within. And that's one thing I must say I loved about Marjorie's book, as a neuroscientist with similar training that I had had. I loved the way that Marjorie was able to have such profound kind of insights, awakenings, and revelation through a process of meditation. I think any conscious sentient being can come to a much deeper understanding by exploring consciousness. Once you realize that it's not created by the brain at all, but is basically fundamental in the universe and is allowed in through a filtering mechanism of the brain, going within is actually a way of going out into the universe and gaining tremendous information, guidance, kind of sense of insight, connection, meaning, purpose. All of that lives in those realms. All of real creativity, some of the best, most extraordinary inventions and concepts from people like Albert Einstein, Thomas Edison, Robert Louis Stevenson, Salvador Dali, Beethoven, and others, they would all talk about how the universe basically gifted them with these insights, these creations. They weren't thinking their way to it. And of course, in our materialist world and in the modern conventional scientific world, we're used to this notion of thinking our way to it. We establish a certain body of facts and empirical evidence and rational thought, and then we follow that towards what we think is the answer. And yet that slow kind of methodical plotting is not necessarily the way to some of the deepest truths and insights. I know certainly Einstein was a beautiful example of that, just drifting off in a sailboat, being hauled in by the harbor police late at night because he just got lost in thought. But that's where so much of this comes from, and not just following the breadcrumbs of our logical linguistic mind, but actually opening our minds to the possibility and trusting that the universe can show us so much more. So for me, personal experience is absolutely crucial. I love the quote from Jessica Utz, who was a statistician who did so much work with remote viewing, with precognition, things like that. She was the head of the American Statistical Association in 2015, and at her presidential address to 6,000 plus statisticians from 62 countries around the world, she made it very clear that the evidence is there for anyone who studies it. And there certainly are people here. I think Stefan Schwartz is well known for having a tremendous amount of that evidence lined up, supporting remote viewing, various protocols, showing the reality of this, not in doubt. And yet the American, I forgot exactly the organization that supposedly summarized a report to Congress, AIR, I knew their acronym, but it was something about American Institute of Research or what have you. But anyway, their report said that remote viewing could not be used for operational intelligence, that the data wasn't quite that good. But she said that in terms of proving the reality of remote viewing, of a precognition, that we can know the future in many different experimental settings that are mind-bending when you realize what's going on there, it's very real. But her point and what she said in the address is when she talks to all those experts out there, all the statisticians, the people who manipulate this data and come to an understanding of it, it's very real. She would ask them, well, have you read the data? Are you familiar? What are you familiar with? And they'd say, well, I don't spend the time studying that because I don't believe it can exist. So these are scientists, and these are the ones who get the bully pulpit with NPR and New York Times science section, who say, oh, NDEs are their hallucinations. They're not real, because those people have not had them. And not only that, they haven't even talked to people who have had them. I notice how Sean Carroll seems to be on the circuit these days as kind of the atheist scientist. He was on CBS Sunday Morning a week ago, and he was there basically to debunk Dean Radin's very high quality work supporting the reality of these kind of phenomena. And I know in Sean Carroll's book, The Big Picture, he very proudly says that all he needs to know about near-death experiences has to do with the fact that one author, Alex Malarkey, reported a near-death experience, but then said he made it all up. And so Sean says, that's all I need to know. In fact, he says in his book, The Big Picture, which is supposed to be a very erudite look at modern science and understanding of the nature of reality, he says that no respectable people pay any attention to thing like NDEs. And it just shows this kind of extraordinary sense of closed-mindedness. It's important to point out when we talk about skeptics, I truly believe that the open-minded skeptic who is very knowledgeable about all this data concerning the mind-brain relationship, the one position you have to reject is ridiculous and impossible is materialism, that somehow consciousness is arising from physical matter and that that's all there is to it. And that's why I believe that NDEs in many ways are the tip of the spear, but there's no way from my point of view, and I realized this early on after my NDE, that you can approach this just by, well, let's study NDEs and learn everything we can about them. Because at the end of the day, people are still going to come up and say, well, they didn't really die. They just almost died. We want to know what happens when you really die. And to do that, I think you need a much broader view at the nature of consciousness and the relationship between mind and brain. That's where it starts getting absolutely fascinating. In that theater of operations, one of the first things you realize is that the old notion that we can only know things through the ken of our physical senses, what I can see with the eyes and hear with the ears, is false. And that's what remote viewing, precognition, all the work on out-of-body experiences, and of course, near-death experiences with veridical perception, shared death experiences, and then especially that absolute gold mine, thanks to Ian Stevenson and the brilliant workers at Division of Perceptual Studies, Jim Tucker, of more than 2,700 cases now of past life memories in children, where the best answer in many of those cases is of true reincarnation. Anybody who's sitting there trying to find memory located in the brain or trying to find consciousness located in the brain had better start realizing that they need to greatly enlarge their theater of operations if they want to get to any answers at all. So it's really all about consciousness. And that's why I love this convergence over many decades of work, both in quantum physics, where it's now basically painted into a corner where idealism is the best answer. You know, that this is a mental universe and that mind is at the origin of all that exists and that all this beautiful physical universe seems to be a projection from mind. And I think the best way to look at that as an individual is just to realize that the causal principles involved in our lives cannot be reduced to the simplistic little meanderings of electrons, quarks, and protons in the subatomic world with some bottom-up causation. But that's really where all this is headed. And taking a much bigger view. And the reason I think it's been so challenging for the scientific community, the conventional materialist scientific community, is really almost like it's burned into the DNA over 400 years of thinking, well, we look at the material world and understand it. If we get too close to the mental or the mind, we might get burned at the stake. That was the risk back in those early days. And it's no longer the risk, but there's this incredible, intense avoidance, really. And I think Neil has, in my mind, one of the best answers to that, and I'll let him get into it, but it has to do with the emotions involved.
Now here's Dr. Marjorie Woollacott, her most recent book titled Infinite Awareness, The Awakening of a Scientific Mind.
When I was in high school, I actually was hoping I could go to college and find out where the spirit or the soul resided in the human body. But then I went to college and started taking courses in biology, and they said, please, that's impossible. I was convinced by my neuroscientist professors that was a silly question to ask, and so I became a materialist. Then, through a spiritual awakening when I was at about 30, I knew at the deepest level of my being that there was consciousness beyond my body, but it was very hard to talk to any other scientist about that, and so I kept that really hidden in a certain sense from my colleagues until probably about 10 years ago when I was getting ready to retire, and I felt then I could come out of the closet and be open.
This is just the tip of the iceberg. We need to go into our first break, and we'll be back with this amazing panel discussion about skepticism, about the reality of life after death, and about what can happen for the tipping point to occur that all people believe in the afterlife. You're listening to Shades of the Afterlife on the iHeartRadio and Coast to Coast AM Paranormal Podcast Network.
Keep it here. here on the iHeartRadio and Coast to Coast AM Paranormal Podcast Network. Sandra Champlain will be right back.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Take a minute to check your social battery. How's it doing? Does the thought of social events make you feel excited or exhausted? It's easy for people to ignore their social batteries and spread themselves thin, especially at this time of year, when gatherings are picking up again after the winter. But it's important to find the right amount of socializing for you and still give yourself the time to recharge. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. And when you're feeling worn out from socializing, therapy can help give you the tools you need to take care of yourself and recharge. Because a full battery is the key to a full life. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/shades today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/shades.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
We are happy to announce that our Coast to Coast AM official YouTube channel has now reached over 300,000 subscribers. You can listen to the first hour of recent and past shows for free. So head on over to the coasttocoastam.com website and hit the YouTube icon at the top of the page. This is free show audio, so don't wait. CoastToCoastAM.com is where you want to be.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
Hi, it's Dr. Sky. Keep it right here on the iHeartRadio and Coast to Coast AM Paranormal Podcast Network.
Welcome back to Shades of the Afterlife. I'm Sandra Champlain, and this episode is dedicated to dealing with skeptics. We'll continue hearing from Dr. Marjorie Woollacott, neuroscientist, and her latest book is called Infinite Awareness, The Awakening of a Scientific Mind, in which she explores scientific studies supporting the premise that consciousness functions beyond the mind.
I think that if I were talking to a skeptic, the first thing I would find out is if they're curious at all about the data, which I think you were saying too, because a lot of skeptics aren't curious. They do think they know the answer, and then we should just change the subject. But if they have a little bit of curiosity, then I go and I start talking to them about what data I have been convinced by out there. First of all, looking at the near-death experience, carefully controlled and designed studies by Kim Van Lommel that is here, Bruce Grayson is here, Sam Parnia, who is not here. A number of these research studies, they're prospective studies where you bring in everybody to a network of hospitals that has cardiac arrest. And then you interview everybody who survived. You ask them what their experience was, and you find out if they had these veridical experiences where their heart has stopped, there's no EEG, and they're watching everything that happened, and that can be verified. And I say to my curious colleague, well, how could you possibly explain flat EEG and the ability to actually perceive what was going on in the room outside of your body? And what I like most recently is that there are now new studies on psilocybins. This is work by Robin Carhart-Harris, in London who has shown that when subjects are given psilocybin, the brain activity and functional magnetic resonance imaging actually drops down to very low levels, significantly lower levels than normal, in key hub areas of the brain, saying that once again, it's directly correlated with the intensity of their mystical experience. So once again, it's the lowering of brain activity that is actually responsible for these beautiful experiences. And now with meditation, Hinterberger and his colleagues in Germany are showing the same thing, that when you have thought-free meditation in master meditators, your EEG in almost all areas of the brain at all frequencies goes way down. So this tells me it's not my brain causing those things. They aren't hallucinations because my brain is going inactive. To me, those are really great evidence that will help with a curious scientist who we hope will become a mystic. The issue, though, is that if somebody isn't interested, I think that I have to have compassion on them because I used to be that way myself. And I didn't want to hear about somebody that I thought was spiritual because I was the scientist, somewhat an arrogant scientist, and I thought I knew the answers. And it took an experience to actually change me to really become open. So that's the very interesting paradox about the two sides of this issue.
Next, let's hear from Dr. Neil Grossman.
My parents are very strict atheist materialists, but their conditioning didn't take with me. And the earliest experiences I can remember, the memory just came to me as a teenager. My first teacher was really Beethoven. His music sent chills up and down my spine. I could not explain under materialist metaphysics why I was so deeply moved by his music. I then went to MIT to study physics. When I learned the quantum theory, the Schrodinger equation, Einstein, I wanted to know what those guys thought about what it all meant. 80 to 90% of them were open to a spiritual or holistic worldview. So that gave me permission to go in that direction. I think what really cemented it for me in those early years was my experiences with my teacher and then mentor, Houston Smith. I took Eastern philosophy course, and when I was reading the Hindu and Buddhist texts, it just rang true to me. But then what really drove that home is he was with the Harvard Divinity School working with entheogens or hallucinogens or whatever they were called back then. I nagged him so much to try it that he relented, and my first, we had some psilocybin at his home, and it was a very, very deep experience. And from then on, there wasn't really any doubt, even though I somehow had to spend 40 years in an academic philosophy department surrounded by materialist atheists, feeling isolated and alone. What of the empirical data do I find most compelling or most convincing? I think if one is rational, then what Eben and Marjorie said is absolutely true. I think you going back to the time of William James, he became convinced that there's a something more based on his studies of mediumship, telepathy, and other things that was available to him. But I think at that time, from just a perspective of rationality, the evidence was it met the civil standards, preponderance of evidence, but not the criminal standards, beyond a reasonable doubt. Now I think with the publication of Irreducible Mind, the evidence, again, from a perspective of rationality, where we form our beliefs based on evidence alone, not bias, right? The evidence has met the beyond the reasonable doubt standard. What that means is that if somebody looks at the evidence and doesn't believe that consciousness is independent of the mind, they're being irrational. Okay, so I want to hold that, and then I want to go back to, again, a personal experience. Late 70s, early 80s, stuff about the near-death experiences was just coming out. You got Moody's books, you got Life After Life, and Ken Ring's work, stuff, and I got very excited. And so for me, when I first read Moody's book, I had no doubt whatsoever because it was consistent with what I'd read from the mystics, my studies of world mysticism, and from my own psychedelic experience. So excitedly, I went to colleagues and said, well, what do you think of this? What do you think of that? Said, oh, last gasp of a dying brain. And they go through all the possibilities that have now been completely refuted. But I asked them, I remember this very clearly, what short of having an experience yourself might convince you that it's real? And this guy said, well, even if I were to have such an experience, I would believe myself to have been hallucinated. Well, this is a statement of someone who's saying, I will not believe it no matter what. right? So this is not rational. And so if your question was, well, what can you say to somebody who very irrationally has decided he's not going to believe it no matter what, the answer is nothing. I like to use the term I coined, a fundamentalist. To invite an explicit comparison with the fundamentalist Christian of any religion who believes that the earth is less than 6,000 years old. You can bring the guy to the edge of the Grand Canyon and look down, he sees the layers of strata of rocks deposited. That's not going to shake his faith at all. Right? He said, well, God just created the world that way, right? And you can find, as there's a part of philosophy well known, that whatever you believe can be held on to no matter what, if you're willing to make adjustments everywhere. Oh, they're faking it, they're lying, they're this, they're that. People experience what they want to experience, or whatever. They have all the answers. I think their biggest response to it is a refusal to look at the data. Now, that's part of being irrational. When you have a situation where I don't know of a single person who has responsibly examined what we call the evidence, the data, who has not come away convinced of it. So when you know that and you still refuse to look at the data, there's something else going on than rational activity. And I think I have a hunch as to what it is. When I was reviewing the book, The Self Does Not Die, which I strongly recommend, it's over 100 cases of documented critical perception occurring under conditions where it is known that nothing is going on in the brain. Right? All these people are wired up or monitored or whatever. See, part of that book, the author's dialogue with critics and skeptics, and you can see the irrationality just piled on and on and on. One of the cases he talks about is the case of Dr. Rudy. So Dr. Rudy is being interviewed, and he's talking about one or two cases which involved a near-death experience of somebody who just, well, dead, and he had been declared dead. He had seen everything, heard everything, and reported it. At the end, Dr. Rudy, he tears up, and he says, well, I always get emotional when I talk about these cases. And I almost said out loud, yeah, so do I. And what are these emotions? And I think that's what is behind the so-called skeptic. They're afraid of their own feelings. They're all bottled up in here, dead from the neck down, as we say. The academic intellectual, they are afraid of these emotions that you got to feel if you're caring for deceased people, if you're doing this research, right? It rubs off on you and you feel these emotions. And I think the deep down fear is, I'll say that four-letter word, is of the fear of love. They tend to be very much into status and reputation and material acquisition and wanting to be thought right, all these ego games that academics, you know, love to play. Just afraid that their emotions are just bottled up. And I think there's something like a fear of emotion. And that's not something that rational argument or empirical evidence can address. So I myself am skeptical about whether there's anything you can say to the committed skeptic. Actually, we shouldn't be using the word skeptic. Charlie Tart, in his book, The End of Materialism, suggests that we don't use the word skeptic because that's a good word. We should all be skeptical of stuff. They are believers. They are believers in an alternative ideology, namely materialism, right? And just like a fundamentalist Christian, we could bring him to the edge of the Grand Canyon and he would say to the geologist, well, I'm skeptical of your theory, right? That these rock strata layers prove that the earth is older than what it says in the Bible, right? I have my own views, my own faith. And so the fundamentalist Christian can claim to be skeptical in the same way that the self-identified materialists are today. And what sustains them in their skepticism is simply they won't look at the data, won't look at the evidence.
And here's Stefan Schwartz.
When I was 23, I woke up. I had a series of what today we would call very meaningful synchronicities, but it woke me up. And I went from being very much a person of my background and training to something completely different, changed my entire life. And for the last 50 years, I have been an experimentalist because I care a great deal about data. And I created a technique called remote viewing along with some other friends, and I've studied healing, meditation, creativity, and came to see that materialism is a cultural affectation, not a scientific one. I can expand on that if you like, but it is inconsistent with the data. I remain a data person as experimentalist. I have found through my interactions with a number of people, as well as my own experiments, that clearly we need to think of consciousness as something that is causal and fundamental.
Let's squeeze in a quick break and we'll pick up right where we left off. You're listening to Shades of the Afterlife on the iHeartRadio and Coast to Coast AM Paranormal Podcast Network.
Don't go anywhere. There's more Shades of the Afterlife coming right up.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
This is it. Your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at PurdueGlobal.edu.
The best afterlife information you can get while you're alive.
Shades of the Afterlife with Sandra Champlain.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
Hi, this is ufologist Kevin Randall, and you're listening to the iHeartRadio and Coast to Coast AM Paranormal Podcast Network.
Welcome back to Shades of the Afterlife. I'm Sandra Champlain. We're listening to a very sharp team of experts about why close-minded skeptics don't want to believe when there's a lot of evidence that our consciousness survives death. Now we're listening to Stefan Schwartz, who spent many years working with the Stanford Research Institute and the government in the field of remote viewing.
I remain a data person as experimentalist, and I have found through my interactions with a number of people, as well as my own experiments, that clearly we need to think of consciousness, as Planck told us, as something that is causal and fundamental. When I was 12, I witnessed a near-death experience, not mine, but I witnessed a young woman have a near-death experience, and nobody could explain it to me. And so I continued to be interested in that without really understanding anything. And then I met George Ritchie in the early 60s, who was like a sort of precursor to Eben, wrote a very famous book at the time. And I have come to see the quest to understand the nature of consciousness as one of the primary challenges facing not only science, but our culture, because I don't think that until we fully appreciate the causal and fundamental nature of consciousness, that we will be prepared to face the challenges of climate change and everything else that is coming upon us, because we must understand that we live in a matrix of consciousness and that consciousness has continuity between lives. Understand that materialism is a cultural affect, not a scientific one. It arises from the Council of Trent. Between 1545 and 1563, the Roman Catholic senior hierarchy met in Trento and Bologna. They were concerned about Reformation, but the outcome of the 15 meetings was that they issued an edict in which they said anything that has to do with consciousness, they call it spirit, but read consciousness, that is our world. And you all in science, you can have everything that's in space and time, materiality. We wish you well with that. And it was very exciting because science was really just getting started in its modern context. And then they said, but there's one thing we need to tell you. If you get into our realm of consciousness, we'll kill you. We'll not only kill you, we'll torture you and we'll burn you alive. Now, nobody talks very much about this anymore. It seems like ancient history, but the fact is that for 300 years, as science was developing into the modern disciplines that we think of today, you literally not only could lose your position, but you could be killed as a result of dabbling in anything that involved consciousness. The last person killed by the Inquisition, which the Trento meetings produced, the church legitimized torture as an activity, officially condoned torture chambers. And the last person killed by the Inquisition was in 1826. It was a man who was a teacher, a professor, who was teaching his students about the nature of deism. As a result of that, scientists who didn't want to be humiliated by being told what they could or couldn't study made consciousness a taboo. And therefore, they stopped studying it because you could literally get killed. And so basically, they took the position, just like children, well, if you won't let me play that game, I don't care about that game anyway, and didn't study it. So this is a really important point, because what happens and what is happening now is that we are experiencing what Thomas Kuhn, who probably wrote the most important book on the history and philosophy of science written in the 20th century, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. He coined the term paradigm. And we are in what Kuhn would call a paradigm crisis. A paradigm, from his perspective, was a generally agreed cultural worldview of how the universe worked, how things work, and that when everybody kind of agreed to that, they didn't have to discuss it anymore, and they could go on and solve the problems that he called normal science. But what happens is anomalies begin to accumulate. You all out there are living anomalies. And in fact, there are, according to PIM, about 4.2% of the American population. That's about 13 million people, plus the tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of physicians who treated people who had near-death experiences, who have had a direct, impactful contact with the idea that, as Max Planck said, when they asked him, what have you learned? And he said in response to that question, and it's in the Observer of 25 January 1931, he said, what I've learned is that consciousness is causal and fundamental. You cannot get behind consciousness. Space-time arose from consciousness. Consciousness did not arise from space-time. It is the fundamental. The interesting thing about the founders of modern physics is that they all came to the conclusion that Planck was right. And so we inherited their equations, but we did not inherit the wisdom and conclusions that they drew from doing those equations. The central thing you learn about dealing with skepticism is its mediocrity. Some years ago, I was asked by ABC News to take part in a debate with a neurophysicist named Jerry Levy and a skeptic named Dan Dennett and Ed May at SRI and myself. And when it came my turn to speak, I looked at Dennett and said, since you have such very strong feelings about this subject, I can only assume that you have taken the time to actually deeply reach into the literature and critique it. And that's where your feelings are arising. Is that correct? And he looked at me in such a condescending tone, said, you don't think I actually read this stuff, do you? There was absolute dead silence in the hall. This was all filmed by ABC. There were about 600 reporters and news directors. There was, first of all, absolute silence at that comment. Then there were snickers. Then there were giggles. When I see people critique near-death experiences, I'm mindful, for instance, recently of Bruce Grayson's exchange with Carolyn Watts and Mubbs. You see the quality of mediocrity. If you look recently at Daryl Bem's very interesting experiments about precognitive awareness, in which he has been replicated now to a point where there is better than 1 in a billion chance that this could be possibly happening by chance. He was attacked by a skeptic named Wagamaker, and he used as his basis for his skepticism the work of a mathematician named Wesley Johnson. And Wesley Johnson and Jessica Utz joined with Daryl Bem in writing a refutation of the Wagamaker critique, in which Wesley Johnson, who was the basis upon which the critique was based, said, you didn't understand a word that I wrote. I could give you examples of this over and over again. I think what we are experiencing is a change in consciousness. And this is not the first time this has happened. Between the 8th and 2nd centuries, there was something that historians know as the Axial Age. And during this period of time, almost every major religion that we see today began. All the pre-Abrahamic religions began. Literally, consciousness of humanity changed. And I think that is the process and why this meeting has as many people attending it as it does. We are witnessing a change in the consciousness of the culture. And I think that that is very significant, because what it is doing is helping us prepare to see ourselves as part of the matrix of life, not as something independent of it, and that only by understanding the matrix and its relationship to the planet will we be able to prepare for change. So I applaud you all for being here, because you are early birds. You are the early swallows going back to Capistrano.
Let's go back to Eben Alexander.
I was talking in my opening statement of Jessica Utz and the statisticians, where she was basically saying, if you look at the evidence, these are real effects. The statistics, the empirical data point that out. And then, of course, she went on, basically the doubters out there, and again, skeptic is not really a very good word for them, because as Neil says, they pretty much made up their mind. They don't even want to review the data, because they know, based on their theoretical model of the world, that it's false. But to end that little story, though, Jessica Utz then said, well, what's the best answer? More data? Or would you like to have a strong personal experience? Almost universally, what they wanted was the strong personal experience. So the data is there. But I think what really can help people to get to the next level is the strong personal experience. And this is why, again, we're such fans of meditation. A lot of the work we do involves some tools, differential frequency sound that intersects with the brain in the lower brainstem, as opposed to most sounds that have their influence in the recently evolved neocortex. And I believe it's by going for the lower brainstem, by getting at circuits that evolved 300 million years ago, that we're actually intercepting consciousness at a very primitive level. So I believe that people can actually cultivate experiences. I think the real shame in what we're facing now, even as much as I feel that the world is waking up to this, and I personally know a lot of scientists who I think are helping to lead the charge in this kind of understanding. And from my point of view, it's inevitable that over the next decade or so, the scientific community, and hopefully by extension, the world at large, will wake up to the reality of these experiences telling us something very deep and profound about the nature of human existence and why we're here. But I must say that in spite of the progress and optimism that I sense in certain members of the scientific community, I find myself somewhat distressed that the major media, for example, New York Times, Scientific American, a lot of the places that might be fascinated by this and want to share this incredibly good news with humanity about the scientific investigation of consciousness, to date, have really not been very open to it at all. I'm very pleased, and I know the people in this panel are aware of some of the work that's happened recently. For example, in our book, Living in a Mindful Universe, Karen Newell and I push the position of idealism, which I believe is the ultimate answer in terms of any kind of framework of understanding. That is, this is a mental universe and that all the physical emerges from that.
This is a mental universe and all of the physical emerges from that. Wow. Powerful words. When we get back, you'll be extremely interested in the closing words from this panel. Let's go to the break. You're listening to Shades of the Afterlife on the iHeartRadio and Coast to Coast AM Paranormal Podcast Network.
Stay there. Sandra will be right back.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
This is it. Your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Hey, it's the Wizard of Weird, Joshua P. Warren. Don't forget to check out my show, Strange Things, each week as I bring you the world of the truly amazing and bizarre right here on the iHeartRadio and Coast to Coast AM Paranormal Podcast Network.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
This is afterlife expert Daniel Brakely, and you're listening to the iHeartRadio and Coast to Coast AM Paranormal Podcast Network.
Welcome back to Shades of the Afterlife. I'm Sandra Champlain. I welcome you to do some research on these great folks, Neil Grossman, Marjorie Woollacott, Stefan Schwartz, and our friends at the International Association for Near-Death Studies, IANS.org. Let's continue with Dr. Eben Alexander.
The recent experiments in quantum physics keep pointing us ever more strongly in that direction, that entanglement's real, that spooky action at a distance, as Einstein put it, is real. But what that really means is that consciousness is fundamental, and it returns tremendous power to human beings when we come to realize the implications of that in terms of manifesting the world of our dreams. The other kind of bastion in my mind, that kind of materialist thinking really belongs in the 1800s, but doesn't really belong in the late 20th century, and how it has survived is beyond me. But the other kind of bastion, as Neil will tell you from working for all those years in an academic philosophical department, is our institutes of higher education. The colleges are hardcore pushers of this kind of materialist mindset on our youth. I'm hoping that we can reverse that trend very rapidly with this awakening, because obviously to change the future, we begin and have the most effect by changing our youth. And that's why I love when we give talks and we have a lot of young people there, but they're not the average. You know, the average age of my audiences are people in their 50s and 60s and what have you. But to wake up the youth, to bring this kind of knowledge and awakening, I think, to college campuses is an absolutely crucial move. And then, of course, the other move is to awaken our mass media. I was in touch with one of my editors for Proof of Heaven just a few weeks ago, trying to put this out there with a whole new series of proposed articles to go out to the press. And she said none of her journalistic colleagues who would write about this kind of stuff believe that NDEs are real. So we obviously have our work cut out for us.
And here's Marjorie Woollacott.
I just want to add one thing that related to the academic community. If you do look at our panel and many of the people out here in the audience, we are talking because we are toward the end of our professions and we don't have to worry about credibility amongst our colleagues in terms of getting tenure, getting promotion, and getting our grants funded and getting papers published. When I publish a regular paper in neurorehabilitation, there's no question about its being accepted by a major journal. When I put the word meditation on it, suddenly it's like, oh, this isn't real research, and we don't publish that kind of research. It's just observational. It's not real science. I think Pim Van Lommel said in one of his interviews something about the idea that our National Academy of Sciences has most people there who are atheists and materialists. And until we change that, we're not going to change, really, all of the young people at universities having the ability to get tenure and get promotion who have ideas about consciousness being fundamental. So as Evan was saying, we need to start with the young people. We've just started a new Academy for the Advancement of Post-Materialist Sciences, and Stefan is on the board, and we're trying to encourage young professors to do research in this area and help them with the gaining of promotion and tenure and things like that so that we can begin to change the academic community's culture.
Here's Stefan Schwartz.
I want to leave you with this thought. There is a lot of research that has been done, particularly at Van Rensselaer Polytech, about how many people it takes to change the culture. This idea that the few change the many, very few people understand that the American Revolution, that only about 3% of the population supported it, and only about 13% of it were actually involved in it. So this is small groups of people who begin. To give you examples of how this process works, and I'm up here doing this panel because I'm into social transformation. I believe in data, and I think the data is absolutely clear. There are now at least 9 protocols that are carried out at universities all over the world. That is, it's 1 billion to 1 that they're not correct. I don't think the question is data anymore. I think the question is culture. And the question about how to do this is by changing people's state of consciousness in your immediate community in which you live. Look at smoking. I can look out at this audience. There are a lot of people younger than me, but nonetheless old enough to remember that when you went to somebody's house, there was on the coffee table, there was a pack of cigarettes and an ashtray and one of those Ronson lighters your mother told you not to fool with. Today, you never see hardly anybody smoking. This is about changing consciousness. And if we change consciousness by our beingness, that is the nature of who we are and what we stand for. Just before Gandhi was assassinated in 1948, he was interviewed by the Times of India. The reporter that was sent up to interview him up in his ashram came to him and said, "Go, Gandhiji, my editor says I only should ask you one question." And Gandhi said, "Well, what's the question?" And he said, "My question is, how did you force the British to leave India? They were one of the most powerful nations on earth. India was the crown jewel of their colonial empire. You are a man who had no official position. You had no money. You had no army. How did you force them to leave?" And Gandhi's answer is the point that I want to make. He said, "It isn't what we did that mattered, although that mattered. It isn't what we said that mattered, although that mattered too. It was the nature of our character, who we are, that led the British to choose to leave India. The difference between force and choose, those two verbs, is the key to this thing. You all are the beginning group. There are 13 million of you. We have 318 million people in the United States. When we get to 31 million thereabouts, we're going to see a fundamental change in the culture. And this change is absolutely essential because, as I said earlier, it is the only way we are going to create a culture focused on well-being that will allow us to move into the future. And I invite you to join me in doing that.
And here is Neil Grossman.
I certainly do agree with Stefan that we are on the cusp of a cultural change. I think our present leadership is the one step backwards for a giant spring forward in the coming years. But I'm an optimist and I've been wrong before. Nevertheless, I want to get back to ask Evan a question about arriving at a belief based on evidence, rationality, that sort of thing, and coming to a belief based on direct experience. I think Evan is right that it's direct experience that wins every time. But yet, having been a philosopher and taught critical thinking, I do believe that rational argumentation, examining the evidence, is important or not unimportant. So I want to ask you, Evan, because you were not looking at the evidence when you were at Harvard brain surgeon because you believed, like Dennett, that it was a lot of crap, right? And Dennett, incidentally, is a hero to academic philosophers, and that tells you something about the environment I've been in the last 40 years. So suppose someone took a gun to your head, Evan, and said, Evan, for the next 9 months, you have to immerse yourself in what irreducible mind and that kind of thing. You read the papers and the books and all of that. Would anything there have convinced you?
Absolutely. I think the evidence is overwhelming. The problem was that was not in my field of purview. But I believe anyone who takes a look at the evidence, I mean, I know how much trouble we've had finding debate opponents who support the materialist position because they're a dwindling breed. Because once they start actually looking at the evidence, they jump ship because there really is nothing to support that materialist position. That is what is so astonishing. So yes, the evidence is all around us. All we have to do is look at it. Certainly for the scientific crowd, Irreducible Mind, Beyond Physicalism, those are absolutely landmark books from Division of Perceptual Studies. But there are other books that I think for kind of the lay press, The Self Does Not Die is a very important work. And I think that book is crucial in getting out there. I love Science of Near-Death Experiences by John C. Hagen III. I think it's a very concise kind of medical peer-reviewed work that properly reflects on this. The evidence is out there. And there are many other books that have come to the fore recently that I think are hitting on the same kind of target, like our book, Living in a Mindful Universe, Minas Kavatos and Deepak Chopra's book, You Are the Universe, a bunch of different works. And there's some that are to come out in the next year or so that I think are also crucial and take it to the next level, like Bernardo Kastrup's coming book in April of next year, The Idea of the World, and there are others. So I think the evidence is there.
Let's go back to Stefan Schwartz.
I would recommend that you look at The Structure of Scientific Revolutions and read it not in terms of science, but in terms of how culture changes, because that's very important. I would suggest One Mind by Larry Dossey is a very good book. I recommend very strongly Pim Van Lommel's book, Consciousness Beyond Life, and Dean Radin's Entangled Mind, I think is an excellent book. I encourage people to look at the journal Explore if you're in the professional community. These are academic papers, but Explore is a journal for those of you who are in that medical world that is focused on what science looks like when it incorporates consciousness within its rubric.
And back to Neil Grossman.
I think that Stephen is very right. He talks about this as a cultural thing. What's emerging from the data, it's not just a belief that consciousness is not created by the brain, but a consequence of this is that unconditional love is the most important thing in the universe. And that's what we must aspire to. And that's what happened to me in the 40 years in the desert is in some way I came to love my colleagues. And accept them. But this unconditional love business is completely inconsistent with the social order we have today. Capitalism is a greed-based social order, and the people who are the neediest and greediest are the ones who went to the top and are running things now. And how we change from that to a world order governed by the principles of unconditional love. I don't know how it's going to happen, but it has to happen or we're not going to make it.
I believe we are going to make it. Why? Because I was once one of those closed-minded skeptics. What changed me was the fear of dying. What may change you? A loved one passes? An illness? My advice for all of us, keep our integrity, share, be a kind and loving person. And you know how it feels good to be around good people? Will have a ripple effect on others. As a reminder, my home base is wedontdie.com. You can get a free copy of my book if you enter your name and email address on the bottom of that front page. I'm so grateful you've been with us today. It only takes a small percentage to make a giant difference. I'm Sandra Champlain. Thank you for listening to Shades of the Afterlife on the iHeartRadio and Coast to Coast AM Paranormal Podcast Network.
And if you like this episode of Shades of the Afterlife, wait until you hear the next one. Thank you for listening to the iHeartRadio and Coast to Coast AM Paranormal Podcast Network.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.